Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Movie Geeks United, one of the most popular movie talk radio programs on the internet and iTunes. Tonight, his new book, The Complete Independent Movie Marketing Handbook, is an invaluable resource for every independent filmmaker, Mr. Mark Bosco. Plus, the Movie Geeks offer their takes on this week's hottest movie news and new releases. Got a question for the geeks or tonight's guest? Give us a call at 718-508-9477 or log on to our chat room now. Sit back, dim the lights, and grab the popcorn. It's time to get your geek on. Here are your hosts for Movie Geeks United, Jamie, Chris, and Jerry.
Welcome to Movie Geeks United this Sunday evening. My name is Jamie, and guys, I'm one of your Movie Geek hosts. Guys, go ahead and introduce yourselves. Jerry?
Hey, it's Jerry. It's a pleasure to be here. I hope everyone's having a great weekend. I really do. I mean that. That is sincerity. If that's not sincere, I don't know what is.
No, very, very dynamic introduction. Chris?
Oh, yeah, about as dynamic. Never mind.
No, it's your turn, Chris.
That's a tough act to follow, isn't it?
But no, it's Chris. Never a tough act.
This is Chris, and it's good to talk to everybody.
Oh, even better. All right. We got a great show tonight, a great show. We're going to be speaking to Mark Bosco in just a moment. He is a marketing and distribution expert, and I know that we have many of our listeners who are independent filmmakers, and I'm sure they have tons of questions for him. Our chat room is now open as well. If you want to log into our chat room and speak with other movie fans and possibly submit your questions there, or you can give us a call at 718-508-9477. And then we'll also be speaking later on the show, the latest news on the writer strike, and talking about some of these new film releases as well. We have some great upcoming shows. You don't want to miss a second of our upcoming shows, guys. So as a reminder, if you have to miss our live broadcast and you need to catch them on replay, I would seriously suggest subscribing to our podcast for free through iTunes. You automatically get it downloaded, each new episode, into your iTunes engine because you don't want to miss these shows coming up. This Wednesday, we have a special two-hour show headlined by none other than master filmmaker Brian De Palma. He'll be stopping by to talk about his new and possibly the most controversial and hotly debated film of his career, and it's a 40-year career of remarkable work. Redacted is the name of his new film. And that's certain to be a great conversation. We'll also be possibly speaking to other people involved in the Redacted production. We haven't 100% confirmed yet. But we have confirmed writer-director Stuart Samuels, whose new film, Midnight Movies from the Margins to the Mainstream, is now available on DVD. And cinematic blogger extraordinaire Keith Ulick, who also participated in our De Palma tribute a couple of months ago. Also on future broadcasts, we have Michael Grace, the writer-producer of the first two Poltergeists, and the occasion is the 25th anniversary of that original Poltergeist film. That's been 25 years already, so that's going to be a great, fun show. And then the following Wednesday, on the 14th, we have Oscar-nominated composer Mark Isham. It's going to be a great, great run of shows throughout the month of November, our biggest yet, so you don't want to miss those shows. Are you guys all ready to get started tonight?
Yes.
Well, let's do it.
Let's do it right.
All right. Mark Bosco is with us tonight. He's been promoting and distributing independent features for well over 10 years. In addition to Mr. Bosco's keen understanding of every facet of film production, his impressive resume includes extensive workings in public relations, marketing, and magazine publication. In his sensational new book, The Complete Independent Movie Marketing Handbook, he sheds light into a world that many independent filmmakers find complicated and intimidating. But thanks to an invaluable insider's perspective and a remarkably fluid and plain-spoken style of writing, Mr. Bosco provides these filmmakers with a comprehensive and detailed look at the world of marketing and distribution. And perhaps most impressively, he empowers them to navigate through this treacherous landscape with a new sense of confidence and understanding. Troma Entertainment President Lloyd Kaufman calls the book the best he has ever read about grassroots film marketing, while Blair Witch Project writer-director Eduardo Sanchez, who himself is no stranger to an effective marketing campaign, praises the book for being packed full of ideas, gimmicks, and ploys to get little films out there and noticed. It's a great pleasure to welcome to the show tonight Mr. Mark Stephen Bosco. Mr. Bosco, are you there?
Yes, I am. Okay, you got me?
I got you. Thank you so much for calling in and being with us tonight.
Hey, not a problem. After that intro, I think we could just end the show right now. That's got to be one of the best I've ever had.
Oh, goodness. Well, thank you. Thank you so
much.
That's
the all day.
It was a great pleasure to read your book, and we're definitely going to discuss this book. But first, give our listeners a little sense of how you started in the business and found your way into marketing and distribution.
Well, it was a path of must do. It started with myself as a filmmaker, figuring out that selling a film really is something that you need to understand as a filmmaker. You're gonna, unless you have somebody in your corner to do it, you're gonna really lose a lot of money and opportunities. I had written, directed really close out of college film with a partner of mine called Killer Nerd. It was a we utilized a couple of VJs at the MTV craze, a horror comedy, sold really well. And when you're in your very early 20s and you make, you know, a lot of money, or what seemed to us as a lot of money at the time, it was great, and, you know, life was super. However, on the back end, when I started understanding what was going on, I realized how much money we didn't make, and started to work through the process myself of how films were sold, how those connections were made, what had to be done to have it happen, and just learned that the only way to really get through that and not losing it all was to know a lot about it.
Mm-hmm.
Realized I liked that part of the process more than the creative part of the process, so slowly but surely ended up doing that.
Well, speaking of creative personalities, I know that very early in your book you state that without distribution, you might as well leave the lens cap on. And I'm sure that probably the inspiration to write this book to begin with comes from a lot of filmmakers, the creative types, the business side of things, it's like a foreign language to them. But it's vitally important if you want to be a successful filmmaker, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the whole story is, you have to find that middle ground somewhere. You don't want to jeopardize the artistic integrity of a filmmaker, whether you're working with them or they're learning it on their own, so they become more of a businessman than a film artist. However, you have to understand the process, or you're going to risk creating something that has no commercial prospects.
Mm-hmm.
When all is said and done. And that's fine in several circumstances. If you're independently wealthy, if you view film as purely a form of artistic expression, if the money you're using to create a film is coming from a place that, you know, doesn't need paid back, all those are fine. However, if you're in the 99 percentile of people that are making film with their own or somebody else's investment, and you're looking to create a career in it, then you better create a commercial entity, one that's marketable. And the only way to understand that is to learn about the business side of the whole industry, because what's commercial marketable today probably won't be 5 years from now, may or may not be 5 weeks from now. And why you can't make a film under those constraints, to understand that, so when you are done and you want to market the project, you'll have a better grasp of the tools you'll need to do that, with regard to language, with regard to who you're going to sell it to, with regard to your prospects, etc. That's also vital.
And you do state that your promotional efforts, at least your thinking of them, need to start once you decide to make the film.
And, most definitely.
Yeah, and there's some early key things that you need to do, and they look very simple on paper, but I'm sure that they're absolutely not. They could prove very challenging in some cases. And I'm talking about, first of all, the need to be able to summarize your film in one concise sentence. Now, tell me why this is important.
Well, that's really the basis of how films get sold at all levels. Well, whether you're talking about a film that gets sold at a film market like AFM, which is currently happening, if you're talking about a film in the selling atmosphere of you and me at Best Buy looking at the shelves. People want to read. We live in a society where, you know, it's sound bites and everything needs to be short and sweet, and you don't have a whole lot of time to make a decision or to read three paragraphs to understand what a film's about. People want their entertainment, their films especially, easily digestible and understandable, and you see this with films as large as the Transformers, or as small as something as Night of the Living Dead, that's, you know, been remade again, yet again. That quick sentence, it relays to the audience, it should describe certain things, the action of the movie. It should tell you who the audience for the movie is, and it should tell you about possibly the setting and maybe even some emotional appeals that are included. You know, there's many classic examples. I used the King Kong one. There's, you know, where you,
yeah.
you know, it's the large ape brought to, you know, New York City, so you have fish out of story waters in some regard, and the emotional appeal within that as well, and the setting, you know. So you know what's going to happen. That's important because a consumer, a film buyer, a foreign sales agent all need to understand this immediately. They're busy, busy, busy people. And
yeah.
I can't tell you how many filmmakers I talk to that I say, you know, give me a title of your film. What's it about? 10 minutes later, they're still not done. That doesn't work. That's not good. Yeah, people don't have the patience anymore.
I don't either. I mean,
yeah, they rarely did ever. But those kind of films that take that, there are audiences for them, and I love a slow, art, thoughtful, maybe described as an art house film. But that's not something that you're going to be able to base a commercially successful filmmaking career on. Just making those.
And I would think too, it's important for the filmmaker in the pre-production phase to be able to encapsulate what makes his film special as concisely as possible. Some other things that you've mentioned is your film can't be all things to all people. You must know who your target audience is.
Definitely. Again, you know, you look at a blockbuster, yeah, that's pretty much floating out there as almost all things to all people. You know, there's any large, like Spider-Man 3, Transformers, any very big, huge Hollywood production tries that because they have such an investment into the film that they need to have an audience that big to, you know, earn their dollars back. But there's still a lot of people who don't want to see that, aren't interested in those films. So even in those rare instances, it really isn't all things to all people. On the independent side, it's even more important because you have a limited budget. So your film better be very focused with regard to its ultimate audience and the genre it's delivering on, or it's going to get lost, or be competing against films of, you know, better quality, maybe not better quality, but higher production value and you know, maybe some star cast, and that's going to be tough to compete with.
Yeah, and I know that on some occasions that, like you mentioned, the star cast and it can be used as a hook for your film. And you talk about finding the hook for your film, which might be the trickiest area of all, because on one end of the spectrum, your film should be familiar and yet have something that sets it apart.
Yeah, that's a good point, because that's even hard to learn or hard to tell somebody what to do, and you nailed it on the head with that. You got to be, you have to be able to be that square peg for the square hole, because that's what buyers want. However, you can't be derivative at the same time and be the same as everything else that's out there. There's some instances where that's okay, and we'll see those come and go. The so-called torture porn style of films, the Saws, the Hostels out there, anybody that could put together a very slick-looking movie with those kind of elements could have sold it real quick. I think there was one that came out, maybe Gag or something like that. There were so many so fast, and we saw it with all the slasher films back in the 80s. That was fine to be derivative then, but now you still need to be able to hit on that mark but have some... also be able to distinguish yourself at the same time, and that is a difficult walk to make, and that's why the thinking about these things on the pre-production side is so important, so you don't find yourself in that predicament halfway through production and you've sort of too far to go back and change it.
Yeah, and I know that a lot of filmmakers, they obviously spend any monies that they have actually trying to produce their film. But you say that shouldn't be an excuse for shortchanging your promotional efforts on that film. What are some tactics for the low to no budget filmmaker?
Well, they should always, regardless of how small your budget is, you should always keep a reserve for marketing, promotion, a way to, even if it's promoting it to buyers, even if it's, you know, 5% of the budget, just so when you're all done, you don't find yourself thinking, oh, you know, even if we had another $1,000 to do this. What you should do is network is one of the most important things right at the outset, again, before you start making your film. Start talking to the buyers, the people who are going to market your film when you're finished with it. Go to a video store, go online, whatever is easiest. Look at those movies that are very similar to the one you're planning and find the companies that are selling those. Call those guys up and just let them know what you're planning and ask them for some input. That's probably the most important thing an independent filmmaker can do before they launch into production, because there's a lot of times when a buyer, and these people will be more than happy to talk to you, they really will. Independent filmmakers, they talk to them all the time about these things. They'll tell you, you know, the cycle is dying, and the last thing we'll want in a year and a half, you know, 18 to 24 months, which is the usual cycle for an independent film production from, you know, beginning to end, is another horror film or another, you know, family drama or something like that. It's those kind of conversations and those kind of relationships built early on that can really set an independent apart from all other independent filmmakers. Too many times an independent filmmaker will make their project in a vacuum. You know, it's sort of self-delusional to some extent that, you know, what they're making is going to be the next greatest film ever to, you know, to hit the screens. Mm-hmm. And when they are finished and they start getting rejection to the project, they're surprised all of a sudden. And it's, well, a couple of conversations on the front end may have changed all of that.
Yeah, and you've been mentioning some things that that a potential distributor might be looking for from a film.
Correct.
What are some other things that they might be looking for? And on the flip side of that, what should a filmmaker look for from a distributor?
Well, to begin with, what they're looking for really changes. It's always production value. I hear, because I deal with the buyers, the distributors all the time, is they're looking for stars again, because the foreign market is in the mode where they don't want to risk a starless film. And it can be, it doesn't have to be huge Hollywood names, but if you look at the movies that are on Stars Network or Cinemax or some of the non-main HBO channels, you'll see those kind of stars, like the Armand Asante level of stars. And those will help, and the foreign market is vital to an independent filmmaker as well. The other thing they're looking for is easily definable film, as we already spoke about. A genre film is what I'd call it. When a filmmaker makes a drama, that's really tough, or a comedy is really hard, unless it's a genre comedy. Maybe it's an African American themed comedy, maybe it's an Asian themed comedy, maybe it's a pot comedy. Mm-hmm. Any kind of comedy on an independent level should not be a mainstream comedy, because people are always willing to spend their money on Adam Sandler or somebody like that instead of taking the chance on an independent film, because they don't, that comedian may not be a proven entity.
Right.
However, if it's a comedy about, you know, marijuana or something like that, they'll go for it, because those people are willing to take the chance on it. Horror films are always the one that's always being asked for and never delivered on is family and faith-based films.
Yeah.
And that's easy to understand, because independent filmmakers are usually young, hip people. And most of them want to do another Reservoir Dogs. That's fun, that's cool, it's hip, good language, good, you know, action scenes, etc. You try to tell an independent filmmaker to go make a nice, touching, warm family film, and it usually doesn't resonate with them.
Yeah.
However, the market would love that, because that's what people are looking for. Same with faith-based films.
Absolutely, yeah.
There's a huge market for that, huge. And the problem is independent filmmakers just don't make those kind of movies at this stage in their life. I don't think they're ready to do it, because they're usually young people.
Yeah.
What they should look for, what filmmakers should look for on the flip side, is a company that has some history to it, you know, there's always going to be a new company, and somebody's going to have to take a chance to be the new filmmaker with the new company. But the best thing for a filmmaker to do before they sign a deal or before they decide to work with a distributor is to do some homework. Ask that person to speak with other clients, other filmmakers they're working with, so you can call those people and give them a call and say, you know, how is it working with this company?
Mm-hmm.
Most independent filmmakers are looking for advances. That's the money you would get before the deal, before you start sharing in the royalties of the sale of your film. That's very important. Only the best of the best independent films will garner an advance for their movie, because there are so many independent films being made that distributors know they can make deals with these producers without paying them in advance. That's an unfortunate case, but just as a matter of reference, last year there were nearly 7,000 independent feature-length films made. That's not counting shorts, that's not counting episodic TV, that's just feature-length, 75 minutes or more movies made, almost 7,000 of them. You know, that's, almost 20 a day.
Yeah.
Ending up in these people's offices. So you can understand why they have the leverage when they're making the deal, because if you're selling a horror film and you don't like what they're offering, well, they probably have 10 or 15 more sitting on their desk or in the coffers somewhere that they can, you know, go back to those producers on and make an offer to them.
Exactly.
So it puts the filmmaker at a great disadvantage at that point.
Well, let's talk a little bit about self-distribution, because you cover that extensively in your book. Do you feel that the world of home video probably offers the most opportunities for a self-distributor?
That's changing rapidly. The electronic delivery method is going to be great for self-distribution once all the kinks are worked out. And there's a lot of places to go now, a lot of ways to monetize your content via the Internet. Whether it's an on-demand setup where your film is housed basically on a server, and then when somebody decides they buy it, a consumer buys a copy of their film, your DVD is actually created right at that point,
yeah.
or an on-demand via an Internet streaming, so when they buy it, it streams to them right at that point. There's a lot of video channels being set up on the Internet that need content. All of these ways offer the independent filmmaker a route to money from their film that they didn't have before. And these deals can all be arranged by the filmmaker. You don't need somebody like me, a producer's rep. You don't need an attorney or anything like that to do it. It's a lot of work, a lot of legwork. However, it allows the independent filmmaker to maintain control over the sale and promotion of his movie to an audience, and he will see greater profits, maybe not aggregate, but per sale, because there's no middleman taking money out, and there's no packaging, there's nothing like that. It's once you get the tape onto the server, the film onto the server, you're basically done. It's just a person either downloading it or streaming it at that point.
Yeah, and the Internet really has kind of revolutionized the industry in a way, and it's only going to get bigger, I believe. All the content of your book, it applies not only for feature films, but a lot of it applies for instructional videos, documentaries. Is there a marketplace for short films?
What's really becoming good for the short film category are mobile devices. There's four distributors now that are buying content, very short content for cell phone, mobile phone downloading. I personally don't watch movies on my cell phone, but a lot of people do. It's a younger generation thing. And when you consider the screen of a mobile phone, some of the restrictions become on what they're looking for. They're looking for a lot less dialogue, a lot of action, a lot of visual action, not a whole lot of narrative structure, and short in length, obviously. So there's buyers that are looking for movies that are 5 minutes and under with a lot of close-up visual action because of the small screen size. You don't want a lot of long, broad shots. You can't make out the detail in the footage. But yeah, that, a lot of the iPod-related downloads, the movie store, iTunes is right now starting to write contracts with a lot of the independent film providers out there instead of just the big studios, because they realize how stiff the competition's getting for to have the big catalog and offer all that. Amazon obviously offers downloads now via their Unbox service. It's good stuff for a short filmmaker, because people want a 10-minute, 5-minute movie to either take them on their train ride or their bus ride or whatever the case may be.
Yeah. It's just a lot of exceptional opportunities out there for filmmakers. The book is called The Complete Independent Movie Marketing Handbook by Mark Stephen Bosco. You also have another book called DVD on Demand. Is that correct?
Correct.
Tell me a little bit about that one.
That just details the processes involved in setting up your film in an on-demand environment, and then the marketing that goes along with that. An on-demand environment is what we just quickly spoke about, but it allows filmmakers and any kind of content, media content providers, to only make the product in an on-demand structure. So long gone are the days where, as an independent filmmaker, you're shopping around to find the best deal on getting dubs of your film. You actually have no inventory. It's a zero inventory system where your film is on a server and it's only created when the demand arises. Amazon is flirting around with doing this with their entire book inventory, so the books are only produced when someone actually orders one. Obviously, they'd love to do that because they could get rid of all their warehouses and costs for all that would plummet. However, right now the technology isn't in place, but it is in place for films and it is in place for music.
Well, speaking of books on Amazon, they can purchase both of these books we've been discussing through Amazon.
Correct.
Would you recommend any other sites to look and purchase your books?
Yeah, MWP.com, that's actually through the publisher.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a full range of other film-related books there, everything from production to marketing to acting and script writing.
We've been speaking to quite a few authors that have been published by by Michael Weiss publications, and just an amazing roster of talent and amazing material that they offer there through that website. So, Mr. Bosco, thank you so much for joining us and shedding light on this. It can be kind of a daunting world for the independent filmmaker, but your book explains it beautifully, and we appreciate you participating in our show tonight.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed the opportunity.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye now.
Take care. Bye.
Mark Stephen Bosco. The book is The Complete Independent Movie Marketing Handbook, and valuable for the independent filmmaker. I hope that was very informative for some of our filmmaking listeners out there. Okay, guys. So let's talk first about this writer's strike and the latest on that. I don't know if you guys read this, but there was an emergency meeting called today at an undisclosed location in Los Angeles. Isn't this great? It's like espionage.
It's crazy.
And it was called mid-afternoon today to hopefully make something happen, make a deal happen between the studios and the Writers Guild before they go on strike tomorrow morning at 12:01 a.m.
Just a couple hours away.
Yeah. So we don't know what will occur there. It seems like a very last-ditch effort, no telling what might occur, if anything at all. But like we discussed Wednesday night, it's catastrophic.
Yeah. I just, like with the newest issue of Entertainment Weekly, they had a thing, where the TV lists, what's coming on the following week, and it had a thing, Saturday Night Live, if there's no writer's strike, this will be on. But if there is a writer's strike, don't worry about it.
Yeah. Bill Maher was mentioning it on his show Friday night.
Let me ask you, would that affect Friday night's show?
Yes.
Oh, it would. Okay,
I'm sure
he has a panel, but it would affect some of it. Okay,
I'm sure it still would, because Bill Maher has writers.
I'm just thinking, but because we were talking about the panel he has on for the season finale. Wow, I didn't even take that in. I didn't
ben
take
Affleck
that one
George
show
Carlin
into consideration.
Yeah,
who's the panel? Who's the panel for the season finale?
Ben Affleck, George Carlin, and a politician, a high-profile politician that escapes me right now. But he even made mention, his monologue, he has help from writers and stuff, and all the late-night shows, they say that the ones that will be most immediately affected will be Colbert Report, Daily Show, Letterman, Leno. Those will go dark, and it could last a long time. The last big writer strike, as we said last show, lasted 6 months.
And here's the big thing. Here's the big difference between now and then. Lou Wasserman is no longer with us, and he was an instrumental force in ending that the last time. So you have no one like that on the landscape right now.
But his glasses are still at a museum somewhere.
Yes, yeah, that's very true.
Let's see the one that wore the bottle cap glasses.
Wait, I thought that was,
No, that was the guy that owned the
Swifty
restaurant.
Swifty Lazar.
Yeah, okay, I got those confused. I'm so sorry.
That's all right.
We just lost all our Hollywood loyal.
He just basically cut us off.
Sacrilege, blasphemy. So as this story develops, movie geeks will be on top of it, but just to make you aware of the latest, there was an emergency meeting call today. May or may not come to anything. Probably won't.
Why on earth would they not, make concessions for these writers? They know, it's these studio heads that are out there and these, all these companies that make these TV shows, they want good material. They're like, oh, why are we not, why are the viewers going away? It's obvious that it's the quality, people respond to the quality of the writing. It's like Alfred Hitchcock said, you need three things to make a good movie. The script.
That's right.
And that I don't understand, obviously writers have had the shitty end of the stick for years and years and years. It starts at the beginning. As soon as they sell their script, they have no, except in specific contracts that allow them, some say to what happens, and very few writers have that. For the most part, it's gone. It's out of their hands.
That's true.
To it. And usually it's changed for the worse.
I think they're calling their bluff. I think they're saying, we don't have the extra revenues for you. We can't afford to share any of them. If you guys want to go on strike, fine. We've stockpiled these scripts. We got reality programming that's cheaper to produce anyway, and then reality shows are the hottest thing on TV right now. Go right ahead. Need us.
Yeah, I just went to Nikki Fink's LA Weekly blog, and this is as of 3 p.m. today. Here's a quote. Things are looking up a little bit at today's meetings. A good source just told me about the federal mediator ordered, for Sunday.
Yeah.
So there seems to be a lot of weight is being placed on the federal mediator.
I don't know Schwarzenegger's involvement. I haven't heard anything about that, but if you talk about the economic devastation to that state,
it would be even a week would be catastrophic.
Well, it would be hard, because as we mentioned on the last show, that last strike cost them about $500 million.
Mm-hmm.
A similar strike in this day and age would cost upwards of $1 billion. This is a major industry in Los Angeles.
It is the industry.
Yeah, and it's something that people should keep in mind. I mean, it has repercussions for everyone in the viewing audience, but from an economic standpoint, it could crush.
Yeah, and I think the thing, it's really disconcerting because the studio heads and the television executives are all saying, bring on a strike, because they're not happy with the results and the shows this season on television. They would love to scrap the season. So that's not very encouraging, but I think you don't want this. Because we live in a day and age where there's so many other sources of media for viewers to go.
Yeah.
Why would you want to alienate them? You don't have that many to begin with right now, but why would you want to turn off the ones you do have?
Yeah, you're unhappy with the shows now, so what are you going to do? You're going to scrap those shows? You're going to get new shows. Where are those new shows going to come from? Is it all going to be reality TV? You can't do that.
You can't. Who wants to watch that?
No, I like reality. I like some reality TV. I'm not a big fan of it, but I like American Idol. I like, things like, you could even put, game shows into a reality TV category.
Right.
And I like those sorts of things. And that's fine. But I also like Heroes, and, I like shows like Lost. And you can't, even if you take all those shows off the market, people want to see narrative shows. They always have. That, reality shows have only been popular in the last 10 years or so.
Yeah.
That's
maybe
right.
Maybe they'll go away, maybe they won't. But one thing that won't go away is the fact that people want to see their shows. They want to see the programs.
They want to see 24 and Lost, as you said.
Right. Yeah. Whether or not one season to the next, they might, there's a little, it's give and take, where this season wasn't as good as last season. But they keep in, numbers for 20, they're still pretty big.
They are enormous numbers.
There's got to be a balance. And in terms of film production, we have a calendar filled with releases. throughout most of next year. But, you know, if we have a six-month drought here, the Cineplexes are going to feel it too, definitely. I mean, there's going to be a stretch of time when there's going to be bare pickings out there.
Yeah.
There's got to be. But let's talk about what's out there right now. Not bare pickings out there right now.
No, it's not bare pickings out there right now.
Jerry, you had a chance to catch up on American Gangster, the new Ridley Scott film. Chris, have you seen that yet?
I have not, no.
What were your thoughts on that one?
We went to go see it late Friday night, and it's very good. I don't know what else I can say except that it is worthwhile seeing in the theater. It is an event film. You get to see two actors at the top of their game, but more importantly, you get to see a really good gangster film. And it's not a bloody gangster film, as I think it's Edelstein in New York Magazine said, it's a bloodless Scarface. I personally think that's selling the film way too short. The film works on a variety of levels, and it's not only the success of the two leads, the director and Steve Zalian's brilliant script, it's the supporting cast is superb.
Mm.
Josh Brolin gives the performance, and he has No Country for Old Men later this week, but he gives a great performance, probably one of the best corrupt police officer performances since Sterling Hayden in The First Godfather.
You know who he looks like? He looks like Nick Nolte in Q&A.
Yes, he does.
Doesn't he? He
looks
exactly like him in this movie, and maybe that's because that was a great corrupt cop performance.
Oh, it was superb.
There's something to that big greasy mustache that that does it, that sells it.
It's the Wile E. Coyote thing.
Yeah,
I think it's an incredibly well done movie, and I think it's worthwhile checking out. I don't know, it will take, you know, as we say, we like these movies when we see them, and they have to sink in. And I go back, I've gone back and I've seen The Departed again since I saw it in the theaters, and I think that holds up well. I think this film will hold up well in the years to come.
Does it feel like a throwback gangster film?
It feels like a throwback to the 30s.
And it takes place in the 70s.
But it feels like a throwback to his performance. I know I will get shot for this, but you could put Denzel Washington's performance. A lot of people will be quick to say, oh, it's like Fred Williamson in Black Caesar and Hell Up in Harlem. No. It's kind of like Michael Corleone, Pacino's Corleone, but you really want to see where he's taking his cues from? Go watch the Paul Muni Scarface. Go watch Edward G. Robertson in Little Caesar. James Cagney in The Public Enemy. That's where he's taking his cues from, and he's brilliant in it. It's like he's taking the evil from Training Day and the ferocity of Man on Fire and merge these two roles to create something just of absolute brilliance.
There's something really powerful about using an actor who you understand as a person is as a good person. Someone very good-natured that audiences have an automatic comfortability and rapport with. Using a talent like that in a despicable role.
Yeah, but it's interesting. While he's I think he's, as a lot of critics have pointed out, he is much more vicious in Training Day than he is here. And the reason I say that is, I guess the third act of the film, I think, says it better than any way I can say it. You just have to watch the movie. In Training Day, he's just the personification of evil.
Yeah.
Alonzo Harris is a monster. And the thing about Frank Lucas is he's a real life character. He's still alive.
Both of them are,
all of them, and Nicky Barnes too.
Yeah, and it's very interesting how their story ended up. It's one of those. It's almost built like Heat, the way they're pushing it. You know, these
it is.
These two titans go the whole movie. They're separate ways with the cat and mouse thing, and then they collide at the end. But in actuality, and the movie reflects this, of course, but the real life counterparts, it's interesting to see how that relationship morphed at the end, because it's not exactly what you'd expect.
No, it's not. And I think that's one of the things that's very surprising, especially if you don't know the story.
Yeah.
It's very surprising, the ending, I think, for people not familiar with the origins of both of these men, and also just the people around them. there's a documentary about Nicky Barnes out right now, Mr. Untouchable, and Cuba Gooding Jr. plays him in the movie, and he's very good in the film. I know that might be a shock for some of our listeners, but he's actually very good in the film. He's not in it that much, but there's an interview in last week's New York Magazine between Nicky Barnes and Frank Lucas, and I really suggest if you can go online and read it. Everyone should go read it. It's fascinating.
Now, we talked about the performances and the content, but with any Ridley Scott film, it's all about the atmosphere.
Absolutely.
How he just cloaks you in the feeling of the world he's creating. Is that similar to what he does in American Gangster?
It is. It really is. I would say from The Duelist up until now, even in the lesser films, he has this thing with atmosphere he gets right. But it's really, I know a lot of, I really was hesitant to do this, but because I don't see a lot of the 70s exploitation films like Black Caesar and Hell Up in Harlem or even the Superfly films in this.
Yeah.
And I know that there are a lot of people who probably want to say that that's in there. And obviously, because of Washington's performance as Frank Lucas, I'm sure there are people who say, oh, he's like Fred Williamson. He's really not. He really creates almost, you do feel like you're in the late 60s, early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like an environment you've never seen. It's very fresh.
Yeah.
But you feel like you're there.
Well, it's got one of the best titles for a film all year. I mean, you can't beat that title.
You can't.
That tells you everything you need to know.
It's one of those titles that you're so surprised there hasn't been a movie called that before.
Right.
Yeah. It beats Scarface too, I guess.
Wasn't there talk of doing a second Scarface?
Yeah. Chris and I have a joke because it's Mark and I or somebody. They were going to call it Son of Tony, and so every time somebody mentioned Scarface 2, we'd all chime in with Son of Tony, really melodramatically. Anyway, I'm sure that doesn't read on the radio. But Chris, have you checked out anything new lately, or made any interesting observations about the cinematic world lately?
The thing that I've checked out most recently, I haven't been to the movies, but I did get to watch the There Will Be Blood trailer that came out this week.
Yeah.
And got to read the review of it in Variety. And, man, I think this movie is quickly, I'm anticipating it more highly than No Country for Old Men. Or if anything, they're neck and neck for me right now.
Yeah.
Right. I'm with you there.
And for anyone out there that doesn't know, There Will Be Blood is the new film by Paul Thomas Anderson, who directed Magnolia and Boogie Nights and Punch Drunk Love. He left the scene for a while and until he could find fresh inspiration, and he decided to adapt. I think it's a book from the... how old is this book, do you know?
This book is from the 20s, if I'm not mistaken.
A book called Oil. He started as an exercise adapting a scene or two, and it kind of caught on and sparked his imagination. And now he's crafted a film that it's receiving comparisons to Citizen Kane in some circles.
True.
Yeah.
Yeah,
whether
I don't know
take
if
that seriously.
About that. From the preview, you can't see that, you know, because, I don't know, that's the sort of comparison that always makes me very hesitant to,
yeah.
You know, I'm always very hesitant.
And I'm always
that kind of
hesitant if it's people, especially people who haven't seen Citizen Kane, making that analogy.
Because you don't know what their feelings are, because it's just sort of accepted by many people that Citizen Kane is the greatest movie ever made. So when someone compares that, another movie to it, it's like, hold on, you know, let's let the movie speak for itself, and let's not go comparing it to, you know, that's like comparing a light to the sun, you know.
The movie is about oil in a Texas town and how the product affects the town.
Mm-hmm.
So I would think the first analogy, and also the other movie that you mentioned, Chris, we're all three of us are looking forward to both of these movies.
Yeah.
No Country for Old Men and There Will Be Blood. You know, we're going to be there opening day. We're going to be beating down the doors. But I would say the movie that I would compare both of them to is The Treasure of Sierra Madre.
Right. Yeah.
I really, before Citizen Kane, that's just me, from what I know about it.
Yeah, I think that's probably fair.
Because it was a Western, but it was a little different, and it wasn't exactly the kind of Western that was being made in those days. And here now, it holds up better than most of the Westerns that were being made in those days.
True.
Another film on the horizon, and Chris, I know you have definite thoughts on this, Beowulf.
Nothing going to say yeah. Fred Claus.
What, you know, what's interesting about Beowulf is I love Robert Zemeckis, and I actually think that the movie looks pretty cool. The previews are very exciting, and I sometimes gauge movies by other people's reaction. You know, if I know a certain person and the kind of movies that they like, if they react to the preview in a certain way, I can sort of gauge how the movie will be successful with similar audiences. And a lot of times I do so with my girlfriend because she likes very different movies than I do. She likes action movies, loves the Lord of the Rings movies. A Beowulf movie would be right up her alley, but we watched the preview and she said, nope, no way.
Really?
Yeah. And I said, are you kidding me? You don't want to see that? And she's like, no. I was like, well, let me ask you this. If it was live action, would you want to see it? She said, absolutely. I think people are just sort of fundamentally opposed to watching a movie that doesn't need to be CGI. They're sort of opposed to watching it. And I kind of understand that. I don't see why this movie had to be CGI. Because as it is, CGI is extremely expensive. I can't imagine that it couldn't be done in the fashion of, you know, Peter Jackson's LOTR trilogy. And is it impossible to do that? I really have a feeling, and I think, Jamie, that you agree with me, that this movie might suffer from that.
I think so, too. I don't see a point. I mean, you're setting them in this fantastical environment, but, you know, even Star Wars, a fantastical environment every single shot. But those were actors. Those were flesh and blood. You know, the core group.
Nope.
Talking about Leia and Luke and flesh and blood actors. Why do you need to computer generate Angelina Jolie? Which actually, I was hoping you'd reiterate your point about that, Chris.
Well, my point is, you took the woman on Earth that every man wants to have sex with, and you made her unfuckable. Made her into a cartoon. Like, I don't understand. I think people see CGI and they think cartoon, and I think they're right. I don't see much of a difference. What is the point?
Yeah, and they talk about, how amazingly lifelike. But you know what's even more lifelike? Life!
Yeah. So, let me ask
you're making a human being look lifelike. What is that?
Do you think it will be as cold and distant as the Polar Express?
I don't necessarily dislike the Polar Express. I thought it was an okay movie. And again, I'm not saying that I don't like movies that are all in CGI. I don't understand it. Like Final Fantasy, for instance. It was a pretty good movie, but it was a huge, you know, disaster financially.
Oh, yeah, it was, big time.
And the base of people that were willing to go see Final Fantasy, whether it was CGI or not, is the video gamers. And that group of people is probably just as big as the base of people who are willing to see Beowulf, whether it's CGI or not. And that's the people who have read Beowulf and think it's a great story. And that's not a lot of people. I mean, it's a lot of people, but it's not a lot of movies.
But it doesn't necessarily... But will they go to the theater is another story.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly.
We've got quite a few people on our chat room, and I thank everyone for joining us on the chat room tonight. Been giving you guys updates here and there. If you guys want to discuss anything that we're talking about or bring up your own topic, we have about 10, 11 minutes left on the show tonight. Give us a call, 718-508-9477, or just bring up a topic there in the chat room. We're paying attention to it throughout the show. So interesting. Interesting film, and it'll be really fascinating to see how well that does. Because another thing, who is it made for?
That I don't know.
Children? Adults? Action fans?
When you make a film like that, I don't know who your target audience is.
It goes back to what Mark Busco was just discussing. You know, and this is a $200 million movie.
$200 million?
Well, I'm sure after marketing and that such thing, it's probably way up there.
I can use some of that money.
I'm sure it is. I'm sure it is, too.
These movies are very expensive, and that's another thing a lot of the public doesn't realize, and they don't care, and they shouldn't, that these movies are really expensive, these CGI movies. Whether it's B-movie or Toy Story or Final Fantasy or Beowulf, that's really expensive. It's more expensive than it is to make it in live action. A perfect example is Lord of the Rings.
That's true.
Movies were made with a combination, and it... the audience for a Beowulf movie on paper and the audience for a Lord of the Rings movie on paper, it's the same audience. It's the exact same audience. But I can't help but feel that the numbers are really going to suffer because it's CGI.
And can I add something also about that when you mentioned the Lord of the Rings movies? And this goes actually with another Peter Jackson movie, King Kong. It's about repeat business. If you don't have repeat business for these movies, you're going to be hurting.
Yeah.
And
we have
Lord
a
of the Rings had repeat business. King Kong, a very honorable remake, a wonderful film, didn't have the repeat business that the Lord of the Rings films had.
We have a caller, 817 area code. Let me take this real quick.
Cool.
It's always exciting when we have a caller.
Yes, it is.
817, go right ahead.
Hey, guys, this is John from the Dead Air Show.
Hey, John, it's good to hear from you. We were talking about you earlier.
Oh, yeah?
It was all
probably
good
why
things.
My ears have been burning.
No, it was all good things. We miss
Pat
you,
and I also
so.
Laid out in the sun for a while. And,
we miss you.
That's
look at you. Look at you guys.
Yeah.
We're taking a brief hiatus here, and we're actually working on our first short film. So
really?
What's it about?
I don't want to give too much away, but we're
trying
to
do it. Wait, let me guess. It's Rumsfeld's bar mitzvah footage.
Damn it, you guys. You always know. You always get that inside track on movies and short films and everything. No, it's just going to be a little comedy bit. Don't want to take away from your show just talking about that crap, but we'll be coming back. I think you made a really good point about, you know, if you're going to do something so lifelike and CGI, then why bother and just get the real actors?
Yeah.
if you're going to do a movie like that, you have to remember, as fantastic as you can make the footage, you're never going to have the same emotional inheritance in any of the characters because they are essentially cartoons.
Right.
It doesn't matter who's playing them.
Isn't it all in the eyes?
Yeah, well, there you go. I mean, the eyes are always going to be soulless and dead because they're cartoons, no matter what. I think the only time that it actually kind of worked, and, you know, I can pretty much explain that, is going to be Gollum in the Lord of the Rings movie.
Right.
And, you know, that was part of a very physical performance, and plus you had to animate a character like that because he's completely emaciated and, you know, ungodly looking. But, I mean, that's an exception because, you know, you threw him to play off of, you know, actual live actors.
Right.
So, I don't think the format's ever going to work as much as, you know, I don't care how good Beowulf is going to be. I'm just going to, you just sit there and you'll talk about later is like, yeah, that looks pretty realistic. And
but what, to what end?
Yeah, so it's kind of pointless. But, I mean, then again, whenever robots are our masters and they go back and play this, I just want to bookend it by saying, I apologize and, you know, I could be great at rounding up the rest of the humans for the Master Race.
Great. We have our first traitor to Skynet. That's just wonderful.
I just got to cover my bases, you know. I got a family to think about.
I know. Hey, dude, I understand, dude. I mean, you got to look out for number one.
Thank you. See? I mean, it's like you're finishing my sentences.
Have you seen any movies lately that have impressed you, John?
No, I have a 20-month-old daughter who's fond of running around the house and grabbing everything sharp and pointy that she can. That's taken up a majority of my time. So I've been watching Toy Story 1 and 2 and Little Mermaid ad nauseum. So right now, that's kind of on a hold.
Oh, I'm
well, you got,
I
you
am
got
looking forward to the Coen brothers going back to the darker stuff with No Country for Old Men.
Oh, absolutely.
That's what I'm looking forward to.
I hope you can listen into us Wednesday, man. Do you hear about our show on Wednesday?
I'm very proud of you guys. I can't wait. I listen to every show. I just don't call it as much.
No, we appreciate
it. But we have to say something. You write a really great blog on your own on MySpace. I think everyone needs to go read that, you know, whenever you post. So if you could give the address.
Sure. Well,
yeah, it's a wonderful blog. You really bring up a lot of great topics.
Well, I appreciate that. Sure. It's just myspace.com/ my full name, which is John, J-O-H-N, C, and my last name, Esquivel, which is E-S-Q-U-I-V-E-L. And, I'm always looking for new.
Yeah, I'm
going to
ask you a question one of these days, so don't worry.
You go right ahead. That's what it's there for.
Okay.
Hey, great show, guys, as always, but I'll get a jet and I'll let you do your thing.
Thank you so much,
man.
We appreciate you so much, buddy.
No problem, bud.
Thank
Have a good one.
Bye-bye now. That's John from the Dead Air Show. We've missed them.
We do. We miss them dearly.
Yes, we do. I picked up, I told you earlier, Jerry, I went to Virgin. I'm talking about the record store. And
we're on a roll tonight.
And I picked up some, they had a $10 DVD sale, and I picked up the special editions of Network, All the President's Men, The Conversation, and that special deluxe edition of Seven. They were all like $10 each there.
That's awesome.
Amazing.
Where was that?
What's that?
Where did you pick these up for $10 each?
Virgin.
Really?
Yeah.
And I paid full price for them.
And they're not used. I mean, as befits the name Virgin, they've never been used before. They've never been opened. But, and what amazing movies, Network. A movie that's so far ahead of its time.
And it just holds up so well, and it just is so perfect for the times we live in today.
Yeah, yeah. It came out in 79, and that's it. I mean, we haven't killed anyone live on air yet, but that's about all that's missing.
Right.
Very prophetic.
Oh, totally.
Film. All the President's Men, one of the great movies for a variety of reasons, but it's very interesting because our next director that we're going to pay tribute to, once we find a good date, because the holidays have kind of jumbled things up a bit, but possibly next month, is Alan Pakula. And Alan Pakula is one of those unsung heroes.
We lost him too soon.
Of films for the past 30 years. You think about his work. He was involved in To Kill a Mockingbird. The Parallax View, Presumed Innocent, All the President's Men, Clute, on and
just
on.
Just wonderful films.
Great movies.
Timeless.
Yeah, and All the President's Men is right up there. I think it's the crowning achievement of his directorial.
Oh, I think, and it's just two directors that we, all of us admire, Fincher and Soderbergh, love that film.
Yeah, yeah. It kind of made Soderbergh want it.
Yeah.
I mean, he's rabid about that movie. And the other, The Conversation, and of course, Coppola's new movie comes out next month, his first movie in however many years.
10 years.
14, something?
10 years.
Yeah.
The Rainmaker was the last film by him.
Yeah. So we're all excited about that film, and hopefully we'll have a chance to speak to him on the show, too.
De Palma, Coppola, I might be able to just take, I don't know what I'm going to do with myself.
Yeah. So just a reminder, Wednesday night, of course, Brian De Palma.
It's all about Redacted.
I know, a filmmaker that we're all enamored with. And he's going to have a forum on our show. I don't think he's going to be used to this. It's going to be a love fest.
It's going to be a love fest, and it's going to be a chance for him to, we want this to be a chance. This film, the straight dope, the hard truth, what's the deal with Redacted? Let's get the real deal, not Bill O'Reilly, not anyone else. I want to hear the De Palma. It's his film. I want him to tell us all about it.
Yeah. But we do hope that O'Reilly can listen in.
You said it, not me.
So he could get the other, he could actually see people that actually know that De Palma has a body of work and that he's a remarkable artist, and that his judgment isn't nearly as impaired as O'Reilly would lead you to believe.
Yeah, that gentleman scares me.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm just sad. It saddens me in a way that he's receiving this sort of reaction to his movie, but in another way, it kind of makes me happy that it's Brian De Palma, because he's dealt with this maybe not this level of controversy before,
right,
but he's dealt with it before, so there's no, he's not going to back down, he's not.
Oh, he's not. No, he's not. I hope he wouldn't let like this two-bit bully like O'Reilly back, no way.
Well, he's got a tough skin. I mean, 40 years in the business. He's got a tough skin. I mean, I'm sure he could take it. And like Jerry made the point Wednesday show, would anybody know about this film if O'Reilly wasn't talking about it on TV every night? Maybe.
He's done the greatest publicity job ever for it. So
he's made it an event.
Yeah.
People have to see this movie now. Probably for all the wrong reasons. But once they see the film, and we're going to get a look at the film in the next day or so prior to our interview with Mr. De Palma, once they see the film, hopefully, though, they'll take something different.
Yeah, I think it's very important, because I don't think O'Reilly has seen the film yet.
Oh, no, he's not going to watch it.
Okay.
What are you talking about?
And I have to say, I find his statements, and I usually do find his statements just so off the wall, but his thing is that if you know, a jihadist watches this film, then he'll want to go attack, you know, U.S. troops, and that then that blood will be on the Palmas. I find that ridiculous.
And the stupidity of that statement, that a movie would mean more bloodshed than actually being in that war to begin with.
Yeah, it's just frightening.
So, man, what a controversial show we have coming up with today.
No, it's
the best
be good.
Guest we've ever had, the biggest guest, one of our idols. Everyone is so excited about this guest, talking about one of the most controversial films in a long time.
Right.
It's going to be a hot button, just a movie lover's wet dream Wednesday night. There, I said it.
You said it.
Yeah. All right, guys. Thank you so much for participating tonight. Everyone out there in the chat room, thanks so much for joining us and chatting back and forth and listening to us this evening. We'll see you back here Wednesday night, 10 p.m. for our biggest show yet.
Yes, join us.
All right, guys. Talk to you later.
All right, good night.
Good night.